Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. My name is Edgar Lujano, producer for Catholic Answers Live, usually call screener, and also in charge of Respuestas Católicas, which is the Spanish version of Catholic Answers. Joe, I don't know if you know this, but on Monday is the one-year anniversary that we launched the Respuestas Católicas YouTube channel.
I only learned that in today's team meeting, so yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Feliz cumpleaños to Respuestas. You can tell I'm nailing it with the Spanish.
There we go.
So,
I mean, you, according to our channel, you speak great Spanish, you know? It's yeah. Flawless.
Turns out AI helped ever so slightly with turning my answers into Spanish.
It's always fun looking at the comments and saying, I didn't know Joe Hushmeyer spoke Spanish. This is great. Like, let's invite him to our parish. Like, well, hold on a second. Read the disclaimer. So. It's all translated, but it's fun. It's so cool to be able to expand that to the Spanish side of the world. And
actual good use of AI.
Exactly. It's a tool, right? It's a tool. And it's all about using the tool properly for the glory of God. And it's cool because there's a lot of bilingual people out there. And even, I mean, the thing that I think we don't realize about us as Americans is people in other country tend to speak, two languages. They tend to learn English too outside of their own language because it's the language of commerce, right? It's the language of business. So especially in countries where they have a lot of tourism, they tend to learn English. So with that, people know of you. People know of Trent. People know of Jimmy in these Spanish-speaking countries. So it's really cool to you open up the door and they get to get a little taste of both the English and the Spanish. So it's fun.
Yeah, I wish I did speak fluent Spanish. It is one of those things where I think my brother shared the stat with me a couple weeks ago, that 42% of the world uses two languages on a more than weekly basis. Like, they're not just like they know high school French or something, but like they're regularly using two plus languages, which is mind blowing.
Yeah.
And my brother, who lives in Spain, is like, yeah, you never hear people here say they just aren't good at languages. That's really only Americans.
The sad thing, my wife and I just got back from Spain a couple of weeks ago, and she's learning Spanish. You know, she's around my family, so she wants to practice it more and more. It was hilarious because we would go to restaurants, and they would give me a Spanish menu, and they would give her an English menu. And then whenever she would order, she'd, put the effort into speaking Spanish, and the server would respond in English. It's like, well, you're kind of... killing the fun.
it's a fascinating thing because oftentimes, most Europeans, English is better than your whatever language you speak on the side. Yeah. Like, that just is the case. In some places, they just want to speed up the transaction. France is kind of famous for this, especially around Paris. You know, you try to speak in French and they'll just pretend you were speaking in English. but Italians, they love it. If you speak Italian, they're so flattered by the fact that you bothered to learn Italian.
Yeah.
That they will respond in Italian unless you're really struggling, and then they'll try to help you.
Yeah, that's true. I've had that same experience. Well, with that, we're going to go back to the calls because, Joe, it seems like you're just a popular guy on the internet. so we're going to go back to calls. We go to our friend Ava in Nova Scotia, Canada. She's watching on YouTube. Ava, welcome back. It's been a while.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm normally in Ontario, but I'm visiting my grandparents, so I'm in Nova Scotia today.
Nova Scotia is beautiful. I was just there this summer.
That's great. I was wondering, how the promise of the scapular is, if you die wearing the scapular, you won't suffer eternal fire? I was wondering, if someone was wearing the scapular when Jesus returned and the second coming came, and they faced their judgment, would the promise apply that they wouldn't face eternal fire at the second coming, even though they didn't die because that's when they faced their judgment?
So with the brown scapular, we have to separate a lot of history from a lot of mythology kind of around it. And the brown scapular is not a guarantee. Like, it's not a get out of hell free or get out of purgatory free card I know you sometimes will hear like the so-called Sabbatine privilege. That is not something that the church actually teaches. That would make mincemeat of the whole belief in grace and faith and even, you know, the role of works if you could just put on like special clothes and get around all of that. That rather, the proper use of the brown scapular is what's called the sacramental. And the Catechism talks about this directly in paragraph 1670, where it says sacramentals do not confer the grace of the Holy Spirit in the way that the sacraments do. But by the church's prayer, they prepare us to receive grace and dispose us to cooperate with it. So they're not magical, nor are they sacraments in the full sense. They're sort of, if you will, adjacent to sacraments. So holy water works this way too. Any of the scapulars work this way, where they are religious items that are ordered towards faith and are meant to help us to remember, for instance, the promises that we made in our baptism, or, you know, it, just to remind us of who we are as Christians and to help us in the spiritual life. But they don't get rid of the role of grace and of faith and of works or any of those things. They're not a substitute for that. So that's true both for those who die now, and it's true for those who will face Christ at the second coming. I think the best we can say with confidence is a properly used brown scapular or any sacramental is a sign that someone is already in a healthy spiritual relationship with God. And if they're using sacramentals well, those things are helping them to grow in that relationship in a way where they shouldn't be living just in fear of hell.
How's that, Eva?
Okay, thank you. So you're saying that it's if someone is already in a state of grace and they have a healthy spiritual life, the scapular is like a sign of that, and so it's basically the same whether you're wearing it when you die or if you don't die, but Jesus comes again.
Yeah, right. So this is not something that is a replacement for all of the ordinary tools of the spiritual life. I mean, if all that was necessary was wearing the brown scapular, it would make evangelization a lot easier, I suppose. But it wouldn't resemble very much the way Christianity looks in the Bible. Jesus doesn't just say, give people a brown scapular and then they'll be good to go. So the brown scapular, like any tool in this sense, whether that's, you know, a good spiritual book or an icon in your house, or holy water, any of these things, those things can help us in the spiritual life, but not in a magical sort of way, but by how much we're disposed to respond to them. And so if you're disposed to respond to them, they can actually help you grow. It's not just a symbol. It's doing more than just reflecting that you already have a good spiritual life. It can help you grow in it, but only if you're kind of open to the devotional life in such a way that you're growing in relationship with Christ.
Okay, Eva?
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for your call. We're going to go to our first break of the hour, and then when we come back, we'll jump back into it. There's going to be one open line. You can call us at 888-318-7884.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the church, on the web at magnificat.com.
At EWTN Radio, your family. And because you're a part of our family, we value your opinions on what you hear on EWTN. You can call our listener comment line 24/7 at 205-795-5773. We value your comments, your questions, and any suggestions you may have to make EWTN Radio even better. 205-795-5773. And thank you for listening to EWTN Radio.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Ask Me Anything with Joe Heschmeyer, and we go back to the phones. We go to Josh in Florida. He's watching us on YouTube. Josh, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Can you all hear me?
Loud and clear. Go right
ahead. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Joe, first I'd like to thank you for the work you do with your podcast every week. My friend and I love it, and it's played a huge role in his decision to become Catholic, and I have the privilege to sponsor him in the upcoming Easter Vigil. So, you know, thank you for the role you've
congratulations. Played in that. Can you want to share his first name so people can pray for him?
Jared.
All right. Okay, cool. Excellent. That's beautiful.
Yeah, and so to move on to my question, so I'm Catholic, and I fully agree with the church's position on IVF. Mm-hmm. But I've had the question come up a lot with Protestant friends and family, and it's usually super easy to defend the church's position with the more obvious moral issues, like the creation and destruction of extra mm-hmm. embryos, the eugenics rabbit hole, the means of obtaining material, all of that. But having said that, I know IVF would still be wrong, even mm-hmm. if those issues were solved. I just don't have a great way to defend that yet. So in your opinion, what's the best way to defend the church's position without kind of the easier objections? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I do. It does. And I've had that same conversation that you're describing before. So I would suggest three kind of approaches. The first is whether we're, I believe the term is heterologous or homologous, whether, in other words, it's the husband sperm or the sperm of a third party. Or sometimes it'll even be a different, you know, someone else will be the carrier for someone else's eggs. Like you'll have egg donation, or you have just total surrogates. You have all of these things that are totally distorting the marital act. So the first thing to recognize is, in the same way that birth control is wrong because it corrupts the nature of the marital act, in this case, separating sex from procreation, IVF is the flip side of that coin, where it separates procreation from sex. That's just, even if it's the husband and wife genetically, you've now separated in this way that is totally contrary to the way that a man and woman express their unit of love. The idea is that the two become one flesh, and in that, the two becoming one, the two also become three. That's the unitive and the procreative. And this is even something people have pointed to as sort of triune, as sort of a very limited, obviously, but a sort of Trinitarian image, the two becoming one and the two becoming three. There's a threeness and a oneness to the unitive and procreative nature of the marital act. Now, that is, of course, totally separated if instead it's the creation of human beings in a lab somewhere and then being implanted. So a child deserves to not be manufactured in a lab would be the second kind of thing I would say on that. And this becomes all the more true when you get in those more complicated cases where it's either not the dad or not the mom's genetic materials. It's bizarre to me, but you have these cases where, recently I was approached with a case where the guy was worried about a history of disease in his family. And so he wanted to help pay for some other man to inseminate his wife's eggs so that she could be pregnant. That is such a bizarre thing to even have to explain to someone why that is not healthy in a marriage, or why that's not, like, go adopt a child. Like, there are plenty of ways to have a child if you can't genetically, or you don't feel safe with, you know, carrying on dangerous genes in your family, whatever, go adopt, right? So that's the second thing I'd say, is a child deserves better than to be manufactured in a lab. And particularly in an age in which there are plenty of children who are in need of adoption, it's strange and heartbreaking that we're still insisting that we need to do this. And then the third thing I would say, just at a practical level, is IVF is a horrible industry. Like, these are people who, whether anyone's killing your particular children or not, they are in the industry of producing more unborn children in laboratories than will ever be brought to birth. And they know this, and they produce a lot of them, and then they'll implant more than they need because they don't have a 100% success rate. And if the woman's body is open to all, you know, let's say they implant three or four, and then she's pregnant either with three children at the same time, who aren't really triplets because they're separately conceived, they're kind of like triplets, then they'll say, well, how many of the kids do you want to keep? And then they'll get rid of the children that she decides she doesn't want. They're the wrong gender, or they've got the wrong genetic profile for some reason. And so they're in the business of abortion and of eugenics. And so the idea that, like, good pro-life Protestants are throwing their money into these industries many of the same people who would never darken the doorstep of a Planned Parenthood, even for a pap smear, is mind-boggling. Like, it is cooperation in a wretched industry that should not exist. So I would suggest, even if you don't understand teleology, even if you don't understand that sex has a nature and that procreation and sex belong together, even if you've missed all of that from Genesis and from biology, you should at least hopefully say, I don't want to do business with people who are butchers. Josh? What would you say to that, Josh?
Yeah, no, that all makes sense. And I think, listen, that's the part that I haven't really had much issue with. I think, like, talking to people, because I think a lot of people concede that. The thing that I just kind of had pop of my head was, like, what if someone proposed the hypothetical of, like, okay, they've fixed all of that part of it, you know? Mm. And it's just that, like, I guess it falls back to it's unnatural, and it's, I guess it would be disordered because, you know, a child deserves to be born of, you know, the marital act between his father and mother. So I guess that's probably the, you know, if they propose the hypothetical where all of that other stuff was not on the table, it would still be wrong because of that piece, right?
Yeah, a child deserves to be the product of a loving union between a father and a mother. Now, we know that's not always how it happens in real life. We don't purposely create those situations where it's not going to happen that way. And so, you know, I know couples struggling with infertility, that is a heavy cross to bear. And I don't want to trivialize that at all. There are also children desperately seeking parents. And it seems to me that there is a happy way of resolving that in which everyone benefits. And it's not by going out and creating some new kid in a lab somewhere. And that's just not the way. Now, and to those who are listening who may be the product of IVF, whatever the means of your conception, God loves you and I love you. That's not the question here at all. I had a classmate who was conceived in rape. That didn't make the rape okay, the fact that she was a wonderful young woman. That it's not an either or. We can both say, you deserve to come into the world in a better way, and I'm also still glad you're here. And I think some people need to hear that, because if we only say, here's why IVF is wrong and don't mention that other part, I do think we run the risk of sending a message we're not trying to say to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it makes total sense.
All right. Thanks, Josh. Thank you so much for your question. Really good question. That was it got a lot deeper than I thought it was going to. That's great. So, all right, Josh, thank you so much once again. All right, we're going to go over to Portland, Oregon, where Katie is listening on Modern Day Radio. Katie, welcome to the show. You're on Live with Joe. Oh, wait, that's my fault. I just hit the wrong button. I just pulled a sigh. There it is. All right. Sorry about that, Katie. Now you're on live.
Awesome. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah. My question today, I have some in-laws who are LDS, and I'm a Protestant. And so recently we were talking, and it came to the conversation that they believe that Eve had to eat the fruit in order to fulfill the command to be fruitful and multiply, because they were innocent like children, and then their eyes had to be open to their nakedness in order to procreate and be fruitful and multiply, which obviously we would disagree with and say he was never supposed to eat the fruit. But this actually plays really well into the last question, because then their follow-up is, well, then why didn't they have children in the garden if they were able to? And I don't really have a good answer for that, other than maybe they just weren't there very long. And so I'm curious for your perspective.
Yeah, I think actually you've touched on one. There have been disputes even going way back about how long they were in the garden. There was one theory in the early church that they grew up in the garden. Irenaeus leans towards that theory. I don't think it says that. I mean, it clearly does not say that in the text. And so it doesn't say, you know, Adam was like a young boy and then grew up. That's possible with Genesis, but it's certainly not required of the text. One thing you should know with the LDS is that they don't treat these passages as divinely inspired or completely true. Because they would say the Book of Mormon is, you know, more inerrant than the Bible is. And so you can't just point to the fact that it clearly says in Genesis 2:16 and 17, and then in Genesis 3:1, that they're not supposed to do this. Because they'll say, oh, yeah, I mean, sure, says that, but they really were supposed to do it. So that is kind of a confusing thing in, I would say, Christian LDS kind of conversations, that we don't read Genesis the same way because we don't treat Genesis the same way. I would suggest one reading. And now this is somewhat speculative. Because I would say one answer is just the Bible doesn't tell us why they didn't have children yet. But we do get these details that I think are significant. Number one, in Genesis 3:15, you have the first prophecy of the virgin birth. God says to the serpent, I'll put enmity between you and the woman and between your seed and her seed. And so the seed is normally measured through the man. The word zera is the Hebrew word for seed or semen. And so it's measured through the man. But in this case, it's not measured through the man. It's measured through the woman. So who is the seed or the offspring of the woman? Why doesn't it not say the seed of Adam like it would in all the other instances? Well, because the one being prophesied, who will crush the head of Satan, doesn't have a human biological father. And so this is also, depending on what kind of LDS you're talking to, there are many LDS who believe that Mary was physically impregnated by God the Father, which is totally contrary to the biblical text. It's also totally contrary to Genesis 3:15, which is speaking of a virgin birth. That's not official LDS doctrine, but especially around like Utah is a pretty widespread Mormon belief. So in Genesis 3:15, you have the first prophecy of the virgin birth. And then in the middle of them being punished, Adam turns to his wife, who, remember, prior to this, had been named woman, and renames her Eve, which means mother of all the living. That's Genesis 3:20. That's in the midst of the fall, because then the next verse, then they're made the skins of garments, and then they're kicked out of the garden. So I mention that to say there's a very curious detail. Why does it, we have this woman-to-mother transition going on right here, and what can that tell us about the passage? I would suggest that we get the answer to that by looking at the Gospel of John. In Hebrew, the name of this book is Bereshit, in the beginning. And John's Gospel begins the same way, in the beginning. And then, if you look very closely, John's Gospel in John 1 and John 2 then has a series of 6 days, like the original Genesis has the 6 days of creation, getting to a man and woman. And so you have the testimony of John the Baptist beginning in verse 19. And then it says the next day in verse 29, so we're up to day 2. Then in verse 35, it says the next day, day 3. Verse 43, it says the next day. Jump over to John 2. Remember, the page breaks aren't originally there. And it says on the third day. Now, Hebrew and Greek, well, Hebrew at least, numbers days differently. So on the third day means 2 days later. Like when we say Jesus rose again on the third day, we mean 2 days later. So on the third day, you were at day 4. On the third day puts us 2 days later to day 6. Day 6 of the original Genesis, you've got the creation of man and woman. Day 6 of the new Genesis, you have what? You have the wedding feast of Cana. And you see two people there. And it's strangely not the bride and groom. It's Jesus and Mary. And what does Jesus call Mary? He calls her woman, which is what Adam calls Eve in Genesis 2. So then you say, okay, well, that's a strange kind of thing. He's calling her woman at the same point, day 6 of the new creation, that the original Eve had been called woman. But does he go from calling her woman to mother? And the answer is yes, he does. And it's at the very moment that he's curing the curse. So he's on the cross, undoing the curse of Adam, and he looks down from the cross. This is in John 19, and he says, woman, behold your son. And then he says to John, behold your mother. That same woman-to-mother transition that we saw in Genesis 3:20, we now see here. Now notice, if that's intentional, and it certainly looks intentional, that tells us a lot. Because Eve was a virgin and is being called mother. Mary, we believe, is a virgin and is being called mother. One of the reasons Jesus right here is entrusting the apostle John to Mary and Mary to John is that Mary doesn't have any other biological children. And yet here, even though she has no kids, besides the one who's dying, she's being named mother, just as the first Eve was named mother of all the living, even though in Genesis 3 she had no children yet. And so what kind of mother is Mary? Revelation 12 tells us she's the mother of all those who hold to the testimony of Jesus Christ. Revelation 12:17 says that. And so we would see in this, like, the reason Eve is a virgin in the garden is because she's a prefigurement of Mary, and that her virginal status is relevant for the fact that Genesis 3:15 is a prophecy of the virgin birth. That Genesis is, as the early Christians call it, the proto-evangelium, the first gospel. Like, the reason certain things happen in Genesis is as foreshadowing of things that are going to happen in the life of Christ. I know I just, like, unloaded the fire hose a little bit, but did that make sense at all?
How's that for some exegesis, right?
No, I really appreciated it. My husband's in the room with me, and he's just nodding vigorously. So I think we definitely are very pleased with your answer, and thank you so much for the detailed explanation.
Yeah, and by the way, this is all going to be on YouTube, so if you say, I wish I had a few more of those Bible verses, I'd love to see that again, you can just play it again to your heart's content. And I also give a talk about this, so if you want to get a local Catholic church to bring me to Portland and go listen to it for free, I'd be happy to go.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, right. You bet.
Thanks, Katie. I think you just want a free trip to Portland. That's basically it. But
that was pretty shameless. I just mean, like, yeah. I want to talk about this for an hour, but I know that won't make for good radio.
Fair enough.
So, there's ways of arranging.
So whenever you hear things like this, I always think of the people walking at Emmaus when they're listening to Jesus breaking open the scriptures and saying, "Where our heart's not on fire." That's so cool. Well, we're going to...
I don't think I quite deserve that comparison, but I appreciate it.
We'll be right back after this break.
Many people have forgotten just how revolutionary the Bible creation stories are. But the first three chapters of Genesis are a powerful challenge to anyone in any generation who would undervalue human lives. In the Beginning, the new book by Monica Migliorino Miller will take you on a fantastic journey through the first chapters of Genesis, unfolding the richness of life as God sees it. Get In the Beginning today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
When it comes to Catholic teachings about Mary, there's one question we hear more than any other. Where is that in the Bible? The answer? Everywhere. In Bible Mary, the Mother of Jesus and the Word of God, Father John Weiss opens Scripture to reveal a Mary who has been hiding in plain sight. Order your copy of Bible Mary today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Catholic Answers Live, Ask Me Anything with Joe Heschmeyer. But before we get back to the calls, you have to check out shop.catholic.com today and check out our store-wide sale. Everything in our online shop is reduced 10 to 25% and more. Books, online courses, rosaries, scapulars, puzzles, clothing, hundreds of great items all on sale. Want to know a great gift for any Catholic on your list? Check out the Big Book of Catholic Answers. Use the promo code BIGBOOK and save 25% at checkout. Get on over to shop.catholic.com today and get yours today. This is a really cool reference book. I mean, hefty. It's big. It's got Catholic answers. So I don't know. What do you think, Joe?
And I know I'm intrigued. I don't actually know a whole lot about the book, but I love the bigness of it the branding of it.
Fair enough.
I'm looking forward to kind of seeing the format.
Yeah, I was talking to Todd here, the director of publishing. He's saying it's going to be a series of three books, saying it's going to be just a nice collection for people who get into apologetics. So go ahead and check that out. I mean, 25% off. You can't beat that right now. So there you have it.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's jump back into the calls, Joe.
Yeah, please.
All right. We go over to, Let's see, Hunter in North Carolina. He's watching on YouTube. Hunter, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call today.
Yeah,
I was calling in because my mother-in-law is a non-practicing Catholic, and she is planning on getting married this December to a man who's divorced, and my wife and I were wondering whether or not we should attend, because from what we can tell, it doesn't seem like it would be a valid marriage, and we were just trying to figure out what would be the best practice on whether or not to go, or possibly going to a reception afterwards, but it's going to be a small court ceremony, not a bigger event.
Yeah, so it used to be, under the older code of canon law, that Catholics were strictly prohibited from going to events like that. And that made it really easy to just be like, well, church says I can't. And now there's more latitude given. You can't endorse something you don't regard as an authentic union. There, it gets tricky because there's a few things that make it tricky. Number one is there can sometimes be the question of, will this be a valid marriage in the future? That makes it unlike cases, you know, like so-called same-sex marriage, where you know it'll never be an actual marriage. It'll never be a sacrament. It will not just won't be a sacrament. It won't even be a natural marriage. But in the case where it's the kind of thing that could be a natural marriage, but there's, you know, something like an annulment to work out or any of those kind of things, there you will find people who take different views on whether they should or shouldn't go. You know, the short answer is this. You can't endorse them doing something that is objectively not right with God. You want to preserve the relationship as much as you can, but also make clear that you don't go along with this. In the same way if, you know, someone, well, not in the same way. Any analogy is going to obviously be different. But if someone said, hey, I want to go on a double date with you and I'm going to bring my mistress, and you knew they were married, you'd say, no, I can't. Because even to do that, I would seem to be celebrating and endorsing this relationship I think shouldn't happen. You might find the mistress to be a lovely woman. You might find, you know, they're both incredibly nice people, but the relationship itself is sinful. The relationship itself is not of God because of the way they've proceeded with it. So in those cases, it's often the right thing to do, to make the hard decision to say, I can't in good conscience attend that, but I want you to know that it's not for any lack of love for you or for him. It's precisely out of the fact that I love you, that I don't want to see you hurt yourself by not going in a way God has in store for you. Those are hard conversations. I mentioned in the last hour that one of the things Jesus talks about is coming to bring division, that there are times where faithfully following Jesus might cause tension in the family. And he tells us that up front. And for many people, this is precisely where they experience that teaching in a really visceral kind of way. Does that make sense, Hunter?
Yes, that makes sense. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, you bet.
Great. Thanks, Hunter. Thank you so much for your call. We go over to Chris in Spokane, Washington, watching this on YouTube. Chris, welcome to the show. You're on Live with Joe.
Hi there. So let's continue in the same vein, I guess. My wife and I'm confirmed Catholic. My wife and I have been married for 10 years, but it would be considered an invalid or non-canonical marriage. You know, and we're currently seeking convalidation, but was just curious if I should also be not partaking in the Eucharist until our marriage is fully convalidated.
You have to choose. So the standard answer people give here is you have to not receive the Eucharist. And I would actually say, no, I think God is calling you to something more radical than that, which is not to live as a married couple until you are, in fact, a married couple in the eyes of God. But what that looks like can be a little complicated on the ground. St. John Paul II talks about this in a document called Familiaris Consortio. In paragraph 84, he says, and I'm just going to quote him here, "The Church reaffirms her practice, which is based upon sacred scripture, of not admitting to Eucharistic communion divorced persons who have remarried. They're unable to be admitted thereto from the fact that their state and condition of life objectively contradict that union of love between Christ and the Church, which is signified and affected by the Eucharist. Besides this, there is another special pastoral reason. If these people were admitted to the Eucharist, the faithful would be led into error and confusion regarding the Church's teaching about the indissolubility of marriage. So that's the teaching in a nutshell. But then in the next paragraph, he goes on to say that reconciliation in the sacrament of penance, which would open the way to the Eucharist, can only be granted to those who, having repented of broken the sign of the covenant and fidelity to Christ, are sincerely ready to undertake a way of life that is no longer in contradiction to the indissolubility of marriage. But then he says, this means in practice that when, for serious reasons, such as, for example, the children's upbringing, a man and woman cannot satisfy the obligation to separate, they take on themselves the duty to live in complete continence, that is, by abstinence from the acts proper to married couples. In plain language, if you can't live apart, for instance, you're raising a family together, then you're called upon to not sleep together, to live as brother and sister, and to not do anything that would constitute uniquely something only a husband and wife could do with one another until you are fully a husband and wife in the eyes of God. This is, I think, again, you know, as with the last call, this is one of those areas where I think there is a radical nature of the decision to follow Christ. So, yeah, does that make sense? Do you have questions about that?
No, that does make sense. Yeah, neither of us have been married before. It was just,
I guess,
me not being well catechized and kind of an oversight, and now realizing after 10 years, whoops. So,
yeah. Well, let me suggest something for you, too. You can also ask for the Church to give what's called a radical sanation, which is a healing of the roots. And it's a recognition that you were not, you know, intentionally rebelling from God, even the way you're describing it. This is the kind of thing that can be a marriage. And it's the recognition that basically that, you know, that from the beginning, this was something that is blessed by God, even if you didn't do it in the way that he asked you to do originally, that's not a willful rebellion. So you can seek that from the Church as kind of a recognition of the relationship you've had so far, that you don't have to just pretend you had nothing, even if you didn't have what you were meant to have and what God has in store for you. So that's very good news. I mean, I think good things are coming your way in plenty of senses, including sacramental graces.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
All right.
Yeah, wonderful. God bless you, Chris.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Thank you for your call. Give us a call back if you ever need anything else. We're here for you. So with that, we're going to go to our final break for the show today. So if you actually, I'm not going to give the phone number out today for this hour. We got plenty of calls on the line. So we'll be right back right after this break.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hi, this is Father Mike Schmitz. Please join me for Ascension's Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year here on EWTN Radio. We're going through the entire Bible and the Catechism in 365 days. If you've ever wanted to understand what it means to be Catholic and allow those truths to shape your life, this is for you.
Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz. Tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific on EWTN Radio.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul? And that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. We're going to go back to the phones because we have quite a few lines filled up. So we go over to Rhonda in South Carolina watching on YouTube. Rhonda, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Go right ahead.
So me and my husband and all of our kids just converted to Catholicism back in Easter.
Welcome home.
This year. Yeah. And before that, we were Baptist. And mm-hmm. before that, we were actually King James only Baptist.
Okay.
So yeah. So we have a kind of a big interest in Bible translations and such.
Mm-hmm.
But so, you know, the Protestant argument is that, you know, in the 1500s, there's Tyndale. Or, mm-hmm. yeah, right, Tyndale.
Yeah, William Tyndale, yep.
Yeah, yeah, he's, he was persecuted by the Catholic Church because he's translating the Bible into English. And, you know, the Catholic Church didn't want common people to be able to read the Bible, you know, the whole argument.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've heard the Catholic side say that there were translations in English before mm-hmm. his time. So, I'm having a hard time finding what the names of the translations were.
Yeah, yeah.
Just kind of looking into more information on that.
Yeah, what makes this tricky.
My old friends and family.
Yeah, right. What makes this tricky is that English went through massive shifts from what's called Middle English to early modern English around this same time period. So in the 1400s, basically anything written before the 1400s, even if you read it in English, is going to be basically inscrutable because the language itself shifted so much. So it's much easier to give, for instance, all of the German Bibles before Luther because German was more stable. But English, which has always been this kind of hodgepodge language, underwent some really incredibly large shifts. So a lot of what we think of as like old English, like Shakespeare, is technically speaking modern English. It's just early modern English. And so the reason you can read, you know, a 1611 King James version of the Bible is because it's still written in the same language we speak today. Whereas if you go back even to one of the earlier English Bibles, it will be impossible for you to read. So when we talk about earlier English Bibles, one thing you should know is those weren't very legible to the ordinary person, not because of any Catholic conspiracy, but because English underwent this really shockingly large transformation in a very short period of time for reasons that in some cases we don't understand very well. This is connected to something called the Great Vowel Shift. I'm going to leave all of the nerdy stuff aside and say the most famous pre-Reformation English Bible is what's called Wycliffe's Bible, or more accurately, the Middle English Bible. And it's from the 1380s to 1390s. For a long time, they thought that John Wycliffe had been the chief author behind it. But more recent scholarship has actually suggested, despite its name, that he wasn't the principal guy behind it, whether he had a role in it or not. So the Middle English Bible. But it's true that there were fewer English translations of the Bible. You had plenty of shorter passages of the Bible where particular books would be translated, and you've got hundreds of years of examples of that. You know, the Venerable Bede, who we call Saint Bede, he translated some version or some portion of the Bible. I don't think those manuscripts are around anymore. So there had been centuries of people hand translating or interpreting books of the Bible. Some of the translations are more summaries of books, but they're attempting to do this very difficult thing of taking from Latin and Greek and Hebrew, usually just Latin, into, you know, older Middle English. So those translations exist, but wouldn't have been readable to a person living in the 1600s any more than they would be readable to you or me today.
Okay. Wait, so you said that it was kind of unknown. Was it not written? Is there any theories about why?
Sorry, what was unknown?
You said it was kind of unknown as to why there was such a huge shift in English.
Oh, yeah. So in the period of a short span of time, English starts to look very different in written form. And based on things like poetry, we can also see that it starts to be pronounced differently because rhyme schemes don't make sense. If you go back further and you realize, they must have pronounced that word very differently before. So something happens in the language that in this transition from Middle English to early modern English, where there's major changes. There's also changes even in things like the letters. So you'll find letters in Middle English that we don't have today.
Okay. It was the Wycliffe Bible. I know, you know, they say he was persecuted for that also. Was that available?
Yeah, the thing that makes that confusing is Wycliffe probably didn't write the Wycliffe Bible. Wycliffe was persecuted for being a heretic, not because of the Bible. Nevertheless, the fact that a lot of the people who promoted English language Bibles were also heretics for other reasons does hurt the push for a lot of English language Bibles. So at one point, the English king had cracked down on English versions of the Bible because he didn't want to deal with a bunch of heretical movements kind of rising up and causing turmoil. So the English situation in particular is pretty unique. But blaming the situation of English on the Catholic Church, I think, misses a lot of what's going on, both in terms of English politics and in just the evolution of the English language as a language. Because you can see other countries that don't have that same history, like Italy, like Germany, like any of the Romance kind of languages. It doesn't happen the same way.
All right, Rhonda, we're going to go ahead and leave that right there because I want to get to more callers before the end of the show. So thank you for that. We go over to here in California. We go to Peter, listening on SiriusXM satellite radio. Peter, go right ahead with your question.
Hey, how's it going?
Doing good.
How are you?
Very good. Very good. My question is pertaining to children receiving the sacraments of confirmation and Holy Communion. During COVID, my family, or my wife and I, we went to a Melkite rite. And we had the situation of them trying to give communion to our children, which is interesting. But my question is, why is the Roman rite not do that?
Yeah, so neither form is instructed by God. So Eastern Catholics and Western Catholics approach the sacramental disciplines differently. And I think if I can give a short version of the case for each side. On confirmation, in the early days, confirmation is clearly done by the apostles and then by their successors, the bishops. With dispensation, the bishop can authorize a priest, but nobody else, to do it. Like a deacon can't perform confirmation. So in the early days, and you can see this in Acts chapter 8, when the Samaritans convert, they're converted by a deacon. He can't give them the laying on of hands that we call confirmation, what the East calls chrismation. And so two of the apostles come down from Jerusalem to do it. So that becomes a problem once the church gets really big. Anybody can baptize, but then when are they going to receive confirmation? So your choices are authorize priests to give confirmation at the moment they're baptizing, or wait until the child is older and the bishop will do it. And so the East chose the first of those choices. The West chose the second one. The beauty of the East choice is that it preserves the fact that there's no reason a child can't be confirmed at even a very young age. Confirmation is not you confirming God's choice. It's God confirming what he's begun in baptism. That's what's being confirmed in confirmation. And what the appeal of the Western side is, it preserves this connection to the bishop, who is the local head. And so you want this connection in a sort of visible way. So I see why both sides kind of do what they do on confirmation. On communion, the case for the Eastern Catholic practice of giving Holy Communion to baptized infants is twofold. One, Jesus says, let the children come unto me. And this is the full induction into the church. This is, you know, the culmination of initiation. But two, the manner in which they give Holy Communion, where it's a small piece of the host on, in some cases, a spoon, and it's something that a little child could receive more easily. Whereas the West has preserved giving the two species of bread and wine separately, and the host as a full host, that just for logistical reasons, it'd be difficult to commune an infant in the Western rite. Not impossible, it can be done, but it does create a sort more of a pragmatic challenge. The case for the Western side is that we want to encourage the recognition that the bread and wine are no longer bread and wine, but are the body and blood of Christ. And so a child who can recognize that is ready to receive Jesus in Holy Communion. St. Paul warns against receiving communion unworthily in 1 Corinthians 11. So we want to balance somehow letting the children come to Christ and also making sure that communion is received with a proper spiritual disposition, which is why we wait to commune people, to make sure they have that proper spiritual disposition. So those would be the kind of argument in favor of both praxes. And this is not a case where one side is right and the other side is wrong. We're both following Christ, but doing it in somewhat different ways here.
Peter, thank you so much for your call. We're going to go ahead and leave it right there. We go over to Paducah, Kentucky, where Amy is listening on YouTube. Amy, go right ahead with your question, please.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just got a question about, I'll be dead honest, Protestant end times theology makes me very nervous. It kind of weirds me out. I don't really know what to think. Someone told me recently that somebody reminds them of Nikolai Carpathia. And so I wondered kind of basically what the key differences between, Catholic end times theology, Protestant end times theology, kind of how that shakes out. And I do want to send a shout out. I don't know that he's listening. Jimmy Akin, he did the thing on a COVID vaccine, whether or not it was the mark of the beast, because somebody asked. And I loved his answer. That made me feel better. And then John Martinoni said that the rapture, we could believe in a rapture. I listened to a talk that he did, but it's going to be like Jesus said, like in the days of Noah, the good guys were left behind. So in light of both those things, do you have any audio resources? I'm totally blind, so a book won't work. Could you maybe point me in the direction of some audio resources that would kind of do a comparison, of Protestant and Catholic end time theologies, and especially in light of the Left Behind series, since people are so fond of that.
So we have an ebook in the Catholic Answers booklet called End Times, 20 Answers End Times. I don't know if it's in audiobook format, and I don't know if you have an e-reader that can do text-to-speech, but if you stick around, we can get you a copy of that. Because I think this is a question people often have. I mean, there's a lot of different Protestant views on the end times, but it seems from your question that you're talking about like Left Behind and kind of the rapture theology from more of a dispensational Protestantism. Is that right?
Yeah, see, because like I said, I know very little about it. I became Catholic 31 years ago, and I was never an active part of any of the discussions about the rapture, but I'm kind of weirded out by stickers that say, "In case of rapture, this car will be unmanned," stuff
yeah.
like that.
Yeah. So one thing to say, just very briefly, is this is a very young theology. The first person to really push it would be like in the 1830s. So, If you've got 1800 years of Christians, Catholic, Orthodox, Protestant, who'd never heard of this event called the rapture in this way, that is a big red flag that somebody is reading the Bible wrong, and it's probably not all of the people who are reading it the same way. It's probably John Nelson Darby and the people who start believing in... So this is... he was, I think, an Anglican who then kind of went in an even more Protestant direction. And so he changes religious affiliation over time. He's just personally reading the Bible. He doesn't understand kind of the Greek context of certain expressions. So, like, for instance, when a triumphant king would come into towards a city, people would rush out to meet him. And so, as N.T. Wright points out, who is himself a Protestant, the biblical imagery of going up to meet God, it's this. It's like we're meeting the triumphant king as he comes into the city. But then what happens isn't you leave the city behind. You then escort the king into the city. That's the kind of biblical imagery being used. But if you're reading it without any sense of the first century or of Greek civilization or Greco-Roman civilization, I should say, then you're just missing kind of these expressions and what they actually mean. So that's the answer in kind of the short version. But if you stick around, we'll give you kind of a longer version explaining we're not meant to just abandon Earth we're meant to invite Christ into its transformation into the new heavens and the new earth.
Amy, hang on the line. We can definitely send you that book through email if you'd like, if you do have a text-to-voice reader for you. But that's going to do it for us. Joe, that was the quick 2 hours.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure. I'm glad to have gotten to spend the time with you, Edgar.
Yeah, likewise, Joe, likewise. So,
my favorite Catholic Answers host. Don't say that.
We will. You know what? I'm going to print that out and post it somewhere here in the studio just so he sees it every day. Thanks again, Joe. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right, well, with that, that's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, join us for another Ask Me Anything, and I'll be hosting, so I'll see you back here tomorrow.